Translation and purport by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada Ki. The next time I see someone performing such sankirtan, certainly I shall chastise him by not only confiscating all his property, but also converting him into a Mohammedan. Purport. To convert a Hindu into a Mohammedan was an easy affair in those days. If a Mohammedan simply sprinkled water on the body of a Hindu, it was supposed that the Hindu had already become a Mohammedan. During the transition of the British in Bangladesh, during the last Hindu-Muslim riots, many Hindus were converted into Mohammedans by having cow's flesh forcibly pushed into their mouths. Hindu society was so rigid at the time of Lord Chaitanya that if a Hindu were converted into a Mohammedan, there was no chance of his being reformed. In this way, the Mohammedan population in India increased. None of the Mohammedans came from outside. Social customs somehow or other forced Hindus to become Mohammedans, with no chance of returning to Hindu society. Emperor Aurangzeb also inaugurated a tax that Hindus had to pay because of their being Hindus. Thus, all the poor Hindus of the lower class voluntarily became Mohammedans to avoid the tax. In this way, the Mohammedan population in India increased. Chand Ghazi threatened to convert the people into Mohammedans by the simple process of sprinkling water on their bodies. Om Agyanati Mirandasha Janandanasya Lakaya Chakshurun Militam Yenatasmai Sri Gurave Namaha Sri Chaitanya Manobhistam Stabitam Yena Bhutale Swayam Rupa Kadamayam Dadati Swapatantikam Vancha Kalpa Tarubhyascha Kriba Sindhu Bhyevasa Paditanam Bhavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namaha Jai Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Advaita Katadara Sri Vasari Gaura Bhaktavrinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. So forcibly turned into a Mohammedan or Muslim. So Brahminical society, that is society, right? There's no Kshatriya lifestyle, there's no Vaishya lifestyle, there's no Shudra lifestyle, there is Brahminical lifestyle. That is the lifestyle, that is society. Society means Vanashram. If there's no Vanashram, there is technically no society. That is human society, right? So what we have today and what is being described here, technically speaking, is not what we would, from an absolute perspective, call human society. I mean, this is all nonsense, actually, right? But unfortunately, at this time, Kali Yuga set in, and so even among the Brahminical caste, the Brahmana Varna, There is a misconception of what that means, because as we see here, Prabhupada explains that Hindus were forcibly converted into Mohammedans by sprinkling water or forcing meat down their throats, and there was a widespread idea that if you wanted to be reformed. I mean, it's not, I mean, Prabhupada says there's no way, but technically you could just drink boiling ghee and that would purify your body from the inside and you could return back into the Hindu segment of society. Now, funny enough, quite a lot of people were not extremely inclined to drink boiling ghee. And so they remain Mohammedan. That's why we see today, Bangladesh is like, I think, 85% Muslim, and India now just shy of 15% Muslim. Is a lot to do with this misconception. It's not that they were not coming from outside. It's not like hordes of Muslims were coming in from Afghanistan or these regions. They were just like forcibly converted, and that's the problem we see sometimes, not sometimes, consistently with what we call like mundane religion, right? When it doesn't actually go to the pure devotional platform, when it becomes sectarian, this is what happens, and then we have all the conflicts of these various types of religion that we're told in Bhagavad Gita to give up, right? So what does that mean, give up all these various religions? Because what does that leave us with? People sometimes say, well, I'm not religious, and that is simply a lack of understanding of what that word means, religion. What does that word mean? It's a Latin word. It comes from religare, to bind, to connect. It's synonymous with yoga, which means to connect, right? So it's religion is not personal God, or is it just a vibe, or what? That's a different discussion. That's a philosophical discussion. But to say that you're not religious, unless you're completely isolated from your surroundings, you are religious. Right now, the biggest religion in the world is being exercised in the form of the World Cup in football. Right? That is, I think they have 3.5 billion followers. That's almost half of the Earth population. That's a religion. It's a religion. Literally, it is. They have the cathedral. They have songs they sing. They have a certain dress they wear. There are great acharyas. You know, Diego Maradona in Argentina has a church. He has a religion. There is literally a Diego Maradona religion, right? They go to church. They have mass. They have 10 commandments. I can't remember them, but they're there. And when they say, I used to live in Barcelona many years ago, and when they say Lionel Messi is God, they are dead serious. Then when you arrest them on it and say, can we just define what that means? Well, he's a perfect being. He's the perfect living entity, right? And so then you can get into a discussion, and then suddenly they usually don't want to go into so much detail on what are the consequences of having Lionel Messi as your God, right? But when he makes those amazing goals, they literally say he's God. So religion, right? Missing the point of what religion is, it's not an end in itself, it's a tool to achieve God consciousness, right? So the question is it achieving that end? And that's where we see Hindu religion failed at this point, because that's what happens with Maya, is that the tool to reach the goals become goals in themselves. Does that make sense? Mm. That if you use a certain set, there's a dogma. We all have a dogma, right? And so if we use that dogma ideally to achieve God consciousness. But then the dogma becomes the goal in itself. We start identifying with it. Anything we do for an extended period of time, we become attached to that. And we forget to distinguish between that tool and the goal of using that tool. The tool itself becomes kind of like the goal, right? And so we see here when the brahmanas, they are very respected in human society, in varnashram society, because they have a great effect on others. Technically, we're all spirit souls, so it's like in Bhagavatam, first canto, the shudra is glorified for when we glorify someone, usually we describe them as sudra, like he's very humble, he just does his duty, there's no big issues with him. That's a sudra. That's great. It's perfect. We're spirit soul anyway, so why bother with it? So when Prabhupada says like wretched sudras or kind of describe them in less than flattering terms, it's only from the non-devotional perspective. If you identify as a shudra, right? I'm a blacksmith. Smithing will make me happy. That is the source of my happiness. That is wretched. But it's no different than a brahmana thinking, no, this Vedic paradigm, these rules and regulations and things, they are making me happy. That is exactly as wretched. So the only reason why are we giving different levels of respect to different varnas in society is because they allow for others to become God conscious, right? If we see in Brihad Bhagavatamrita, where we go through like levels of devotees, first there is the Prayag Brahmana. He's a perfect human being, but that's where we start. See, the next guy explained is the southern king. Now, from a varna perspective, he's lower because he's a king. He's a kshatriya. He's not a brahmana. So why is he glorified more? Because his effect on the surroundings is greater. The brahmana is just kind of doing his thing. But the southern king is producing an environment where enormous amounts of people can become devotees. That's what Krishna likes, right? So as long as we identify as devotees, the varna is not really, it's pretty superfluous. It's there. So that's the mistake we sometimes make is, oh, so we're devotees, we can do anything. Yeah, but you can, but you're not going to be equally good at everything, right? So like a year ago, I went from saffron to white, and then suddenly there are bills to pay. There are things that you have to take into consideration that I had happily forgotten for many years, right? And I've come to understand that I am approximately 0% Vaishya. It's just a fact, right? So you could say, oh, I'm a devotee, I can do anything. Yeah, but why would you do something that you're really bad at? You can. Definitely you can, but why would you, right? If the point is to make Krishna happy, why wouldn't you do something that you're good at, right? So it's a tightrope. It's a balance between neglecting the regulations and then becoming attached to them, right? Those are the two diversions that we see, that we call them the smarta diversion, and then the oh my God, it's gone. Yeah, sahaja. Yeah, exactly. Right? The smarta means you're attached to the rules and regulations. The rules and regulations will make me happy. They are what makes me a good devotee. And if I'm a higher varna, or if I'm following more strictly than others, that means I'm a better devotee than others. But where's the devotion in that? It's called devotional service, so it has two elements. Right? Prabhupada, very expertly. He's not whimsical. When devotional service, the service that you perform, some, but then there's the mood of devotion. So there's an internal and external manifestation of love of God, right? So on the smarta deviation, you get too much attached to the service part and you forget the devotion. So then suddenly you have people converting into Muslims and not being able to find their way back to where they kind of came from. And it's not a problem to be a Muslim. Who cares? That's religion. That's another thing. I was, some of you may be familiar with Veda London. It's a networking event in London. I was asked to speak there. And so we're talking, and at the end of my talk, there's a Q&A, and this elderly gentleman ask a question about Sufism, which is the Muslim mystical or kind of bhakti. There's a lot of similarities to bhakti in that tradition. And so afterwards we're talking, and he's a Muslim, and he knows that I'm bhakti yoga, Hari Bol. And so we're discussing, and we're not discussing religion. We're just talking straight up Vedanta. We're not quoting verses because he reads different books than me, but we're just discussing the reality of devotion to God. So he's a Muslim, I'm a Hindu or, you know, Vaishnava, but it doesn't matter because we're discussing the same thing, right? So this is not, I mean, convert into Muslim, sure. Chant Hare Krishna. Do whatever, and you can, as we'll see as we go along, Mahaprabhu is not impressed by this. It's not like something that affects him, right? Because it's not about religion. And then, of course, we're living in the West, and usually anything related to regulation and sense control is not you know, gets us a little uncomfortable. So we have a tendency usually to go on the other side of the sahaja, right, where we're back at this, oh, I'm a devotee, I can do whatever I want. Yeah, but how do you decide what to do? It's either going to be shastra or your mind. And your mind is your conditioning. It's an accumulation of all your conditioning through millions of lives. And that's what we're trying to get rid of. So if we use that to make decisions with, we're not going to decrease our conditioning. We're going to increase our conditioning. So that's the other side, right? So that's why we have to go by authority. There's just no way. And we don't like this word authority because that means I'm not in charge. But hey, you're not in charge anyway. That's the illusion to think that I'm the controller and enjoyer. That's the whole point of it. We think we're in charge. We're not. So it's either going to be just following the modes. That's what we call under the modes. Is that it's just some days you're going to have good days. You're going to be real nice. And then other days you're going to be grumpy because someone said something at some point. And that's just what it's going to be. So we have to understand that. In the right context, if we understand Varnashram correctly, it doesn't limit us. All it does is it removes all the options that are not going to work anyway, right? So I was discussing with another a guy who's very modern guy, and he was like on his like fifth relationship. And he was saying, this is great because I've learned so much, you know, I know myself better from all these failed relationships. And I'm like, but wouldn't it be better if you didn't have to go through those first four ones? Right? It's not like there are various ways of learning, right? You can try, there's the easy way where you try to introspect and you try to learn from authorities, or there's the hard way, just get out there and get knocked around until you get it, right? So and do whatever you want. If it works, it works. It's just we recommend the easy way, right? So if we see like Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, I mean, it's all about spontaneous devotion, right? That's this whole movement that he starts. But at the same time, he's very rigidly following. You know, takes sannyas, and he's very strict, actually. So that's just the foundation on which you can build your devotion, right? So the modern material life, the material energy, is trouble. We're not supposed to be here. We're not meant to be here. It's not meant to be nice, right? There are degrees of trouble. So you have heavenly planets where everything's kind of, you know, pretty steady going. And then you have more hellish regions like, you know, downtown London or other places like that, right? Where everything's confusing. Everyone's busy going round in circles, right? But it is going to be trouble. We don't have to seek it out, right? We don't have to search out the problems. Jai Shri Radha Gokula Ananda Ki. Sitaram Lakshman Hanumanaki Gornitayaki. So we don't have to seek that out. How is it? We may be done with the past, but the past is not done with us. Right? So our conditioning and our illusion will get us into trouble anyway. We want to try and mitigate that, because all the energy that we're not using on failed relationships and trying to be in a certain profession that you're not suited for, or whatever it is that we're trying to realize ourselves in the modern context, if we save that energy, we can use it for something more constructive, like Hare Krishna, right? There is a certain limited amount of consciousness that we have. We're very small, so we shouldn't waste it on things that we don't have to waste our time with, right? But this idea that I'm the controller and enjoyer and that I can be whatever I want, like it's a free country, right? We were discussing, not so long ago, we were discussing Sambandha Abhideya Prayojana, like these three terms that you use to actually describe reality. If you see Prabhupada is always using it to how he may not specifically mention the terms, but he's always using it in his breakdown of the philosophy. And we were this funny point that we want to do whatever we want and get whatever we want, and that's an impossibility. You can't. You have to decide. If you want a specific goal, there is a certain way to get it, right? And like we're using the example of a degree from Oxford, you have to act in a certain way to get that degree. And if you want to do whatever you want, well, then you have to accept whatever comes. So this idea that I can go out and be whatever I want and do whatever I want, and this is a free country, yeah, it is. And that's why there is suffering, because then you have to accept whatever comes, right? So you have this idea that, no, but you can't implement Van Ashram in a place like London. This is 2018, people not... But that's misunderstood, because it is implemented. Krishna implemented it. That's the system. Like, that's how Krishna likes it, so that's how it works. And so when people are like, oh, but the people are so stressed and they can't... No, but that's why they're stressed. Right, you have to flip it around. You're looking at it from this banyan tree with the roots up and down, and you can't describe in 15th chapter of Bhagavad Gita. So cause and effect gets switched around. I can't follow Van Ashram because I'm stressed. No, you're stressed because you're not following Van Ashram. So that's the way it is with anything. You want a goal, you have to set aside your immediate desires. You have to have a little bit of faith in it. If you look at how much faith people put in football, just to go back to that example, right? People spend thousands going to Moscow to look at 22 guys, you know, kicking a ball around. There's this story of I think it was Aurangzeb, actually, who wanted to impress a southern king with his, you know, connections to the West. And so he set up a football match, and the southern king was not impressed. He said, look, I'm a generous king. I would just give them each a ball instead of having them fight over one. Right? So we have to get real here. Where are we putting our energy? If we get this faith in that, no, I mean... There's another guy, he was asking me who's going to win the Euro Cup. That's a couple of years ago when it was the Euro Cup. Now it's the World Cup. And my answer was nobody. They're all going to lose because they think that this is going to make them happy. You've already lost. One thing is that all teams except one are going to lose. But then the winners are actually the biggest losers because they think now we've got something. We did it. We've got something. And one thing is that it's going to be taken away from them again, like... 4 years later, who cares, right? But another thing is that if you actually seriously think that football is going to make you happy, you're in trouble. You're in trouble, right? And the more faith you have in this material energy, the more trouble you're in. That's why it's actually very dangerous to identify with your conditioning, right? Because the better you are at it, the worse you're off. Like, you go to the football, they drink beer. Take a high-profile lawyer. He doesn't have time for beer. He drinks hard liquor. You know, there's no time, you know. So he's in greater trouble. They're the ones who burn out. We have all these self-help gurus saying, find your passion and burn for it, work hard. That's nonsense. Don't do that, you know. I mean, do your duty, do your work, but this whole crush it, awaken the beast within and stuff like that, that's what gets us in trouble. Because either you're going to lose out, it's not going to work, and you're going to be frustrated, or it will work, and you're going to think, I'm the king of the world. That's even worse. So you can only lose. There's no way, philosophically speaking. I'm just pragmatically saying, you can't win. So you have to shift the identity, right? You don't have to shift the work. Be a lawyer, but just be a devotee lawyer. Don't identify as a lawyer or a Christian or a Muslim or whatever. You're a child of God, you're spirit soul, you're transcendental. And the body we move around in is just the vessel. It's the tool for achieving something, right? But if you if you're driving in a car, you can't drive off down to the harbor and off the pier and into the water and sail off into the sunset because it's a car. It doesn't matter. I'm not the body. You're not the car, but the car is the car. So if you think, oh, I'm not the car, so I'll use it as a boat, you're going to get in trouble. It's the same thing with our body. There's a nature. It has a certain nature. There are things that come natural to us, you know. Richard Branson, he's a Vaishya, 100%, right? He found his Varna. Went pretty well. But he may not know how that works, but he just knows how it works. It's just intuitively, it just works, right? So I can sit and read for hours on end and just not, it's just something I can do, right? Other people, they're like, that's why sometimes our book distribution is not working, because people are like, you have to explain to them. It's like a tablet, but there's just many, many tablets, and the picture doesn't move. And they're like, oh, okay, you know. But people can't read anything longer than a tweet these days, right? It's like, what the hell? There's so many words. So because we've gotten conditioned to this instant gratification, you click and colors and bleep blop and new stuff, and so we can't focus anymore, right? So we have to find out how to get in touch with people again. The fact is that, you know, we haven't basically grown in 30, 40 years since Prabhupada left. Am I wrong? We're not really growing because we're not using this properly. We don't understand the connection between the primary and the secondary. The primary being love and devotion for God, and the secondary being whatever tools we're using to achieve that, right? So we and it's funny because we kind of go on both sides. We deviate both to the smarter side and the sahaja side. That on one level, it's like, oh, no, we get attached to the process, like book distribution. Prabhupada did book distribution, so we're going out, just getting the books out there. And then when we try to explain why nobody's coming to the temple, we say, well, time bomb. Give them 20 years, and suddenly it'll click. But it's been 30 years. So when is it going to click? I'm a time bomb myself, actually. I did have a book for 16 years before I opened it. And it happened. So I'm not saying it's not true, but it's not in the sense that we're looking at a situation where we have to start doing something here, because we need to make a lot of devotees. Right now, we're dependent a lot on Hindu donations, and those Hindus are in their 60s and 70s. And when they leave their body and go back to Godhead, their sons are not going to be as generous because they are way more integrated into modern society. They don't need a social club, right? So we have to start actually making some devotees here. So how does that happen? It happens by understanding the primary and the secondary, love of God and the tools that you use to express it. Because people, they see the devotees on the street and they think there's something here. There's something here, right? It's attractive. It is. I mean, generally, we're well-liked. There are, you know, people are dead scared of religion and cults and sects and all these things. Generally, we're not so much the target of that. We're generally a jolly bunch. So there is that devotion is there. Yeah, he's the king of it, by the way. He's the dancer of all dancers. Have you seen him dance? He's amazing. So the attraction is there, but then we make the huge mistake of opening our mouth and start preaching to them. Mm. Right? And then off they go. Right? Because that what? You know, no, this is modern society. They don't relate to it. So generally, in the beginning, it's just like kirtan, prasad, you know, just stuff them full of prasad and become their friend. Then, when they choose to take it up and be serious, then we start preaching philosophy, right? I was doing this ask a monk thing, some of you may know. I'm sitting like in major cities around the West with a little sign that says, ask a monk any topic, right? And so I'm sitting there. People come over because they're looking for something. Usually they're shopping. Usually it's like a shopping area, I find, because I stand out so much that people, they feel they have to come over and talk to me. What the hell are you doing here? it's not Varnashram I'm usually talking with these people about. But it's very deep, actually. People want to know what's my role in life? Who am I? What am I doing? How do I know if I'm a good person? People actually want to know these things, right? And then, of course, you have the odd, any topic, and then they come and try and give some kind of trick question, like, what's the biggest building in Phoenix? One guy was saying. But then you just flip it around. Then you just trick him. I said, well, the biggest building in Phoenix is the reason you're not making progress in life. And he was like, what? No. Because you come here and you see a guy and he says, literally, you can ask him anything and this is the best thing you can come up with. I bet you know already what the biggest building in Phoenix is. So why are you asking me? You're wasting your time trying to be clever. It's true. He just wasted an opportunity. So that's preaching, right? It's not, preaching is not drink boiling ghee to purify yourself, or you're not the body Prabhu. I mean, if someone is not already on that track, it doesn't really help discussing with them. People are not convinced by arguments. I have never convinced anyone of anything, right? If people disagree, they will disagree. It doesn't matter. And it just gets more annoying the more convincing you are in arguing the opposite, right? So people can change themselves if they feel attracted to that. So if we become their friend, if we relate to them on a very personal level, on a very personal plane, they will be attracted. Then they will start asking. That's the principle of authority. We're talking here about authority. Is that it has to be given. You can't take it. You get, well, I'm very senior. I've got Brahman thread. I got Tilak. You know, so therefore you have to listen to me. No, they will listen if they are inclined to listen, and they will be inclined to listen if they feel protected. That's the Kshatriya principle, right? Protection. It's not war. It's protection, right? So we have to start doing that. We have to start putting a little bit more effort into this. Like what Mahaprabhu is doing here is he's inspiring people, you know. And it doesn't matter what this Jantkazi comes and says, you know, I'll confiscate their possessions. What possessions? I don't own anything. If I look at everything I had 10 years ago, I don't know if any of it is left now. I don't know where it is. Maybe a couple of books, actually, but that's pretty much it, right? It's just, it's here for our use. We can use it for a certain amount of time, and then it decays. That's the material principle. Everything decays. Everything goes away, except devotion, right? So they are tools, things that we have in our quote-unquote possession, are tools to achieve devotion. So if we have hordes of people who are already experiencing that devotion, who cares about the possessions, right? They're secondary. Now, since we get attached to our possessions, and especially if we're talking in relation to preaching, people are very attached to their possessions. So Varnashram is a way to illustrate that you don't have to give that up. All you have to give up is the idea that it's yours and it's for your pleasure. That's where the frustration comes, because you can't satisfy that. It's just the more you have, the more you want, and you get used to that certain level. So when something decays, or you get fired, or one of the five relationships ends, you get frustrated because it's not supposed to be like that. The spiritual principle is abundance. The spiritual principle is expansion. Everything expands when it's spiritual, right? Everything grows. That is the spirit. That's the difference between a live body and a dead body. The spirit, right? And everything material, once the spirit is gone, it decays. Doesn't matter what it is. You come back after 5 years and it's kind of dented, and it's got, what is it, patina, right? It's breaking down. Everything is breaking down as we speak. My body is breaking down as we speak. That's why we have to keep cleaning the temple, because dead skin cells are actually falling all over the place right now. I'm sorry if that's a gross example, but we are reincarnating right now, right? I think our skin is about a month or so it takes for it to regenerate. So last time I gave class here, what you're looking at wasn't here, right? It didn't exist. And what you looked at that time is dead. It's gone. Human cells have a max lifespan, I think, of about 7 years. Some say 10, I believe, but there's always disagreements. Which means I had a birthday 2 days ago. I'm 43, thank you. So I'm working on my fifth body, right? Complete change of all cells in my body have occurred four times, and now I'm working on the fifth, right? So understanding this, we are literally not the body. Modern science has proven that, right? We are the spirit. There's something, because if we don't acknowledge the spirit, then basically I'm a completely different person from I was yesterday. So whatever I did yesterday, you can't hold me responsible for it because that was another guy, right? Sounds great, right? But you can't really have a society based on that notion. So there's something that remains. There's something that decays, and then there's something that remains. That is the spirit. That is the soul, right? That's the true identity. So understanding that we need Vanashram. This is ISKCON, the International Society for Krishna Consciousness. That society, that word is very significant, right? That means Vanashram. From a Vedic perspective, from a human perspective, society means Vanashram. Otherwise, it's animal society. It's just everybody just kind of going along and trying to get their own satisfaction maximized, right? We call it pranamoy, extended sense gratification, that we all make deals and rules and regulations for how we can enjoy the maximum, right? You see people, I mean, I was in a conversation recently, and I was just looking at it. It became a very philosophical experience because it was so evident that nobody gave a damn about what each other said. It was just that there was a silent agreement that, okay, now you talk, and then now you feel like the center of the universe. And then when you've spoken for a while, then I take over. Now I'm the center of the universe. And from an outside perspective, it looked very civilized, and it was a lot of four-syllable words trying to impress each other with very advanced language. But if you notice the thread of it, it was like completely fragmented. There was no thread. It was just like someone says something else. There's no connection between it. It's not like they're building off each other. You say, okay, now you said something, now I say something. And if you look at it immediately, it looks kind of civilized. But it's not. It's just animal society. That's not human. Human means that there is an understanding of Dharma, that there is an actual reality. Not just my perspective. I saw in Mumbai one time, I saw one guy had written the Bhagavad Gita as I see it. Not as it is, but as I see it. Who cares? You know, it's Krishna. It's God speaking. Who cares about your conditioning? Why are we reading about that? You know? But that's modern society. It's all about my conditioning. So the Varnashram system allows us to mitigate that, to reverse that, the direction of our movement in life to away from the material towards the spiritual. But when that becomes an attachment in itself, then you have these, it's just another issue. I mean, say what you will about Maya, but she's good, right? You're meditating, you're chanting, and it's really, you're disappearing into the mantra, and suddenly you're thinking, I'm so freaking self-realized. Right? That's how it is. Like the tool that is getting you out becomes the ball and chain. Right? Because you start identifying with that. You start noticing that instead of Krishna. Right? It's just how Maya works, and it's very, very subtle. And so if we're not using Varnashram, if we're not making our decisions based on Shastra, we will be basing it on our mind, our accumulated conditioning, which is exactly what got us into trouble in the first place, right? So that's why it's just necessary. And then, yeah, two sides. One side is to acknowledge that we have to use it, but then at the same time acknowledge that we have to be ready to give it up at any time, right? When it's no longer useful, because otherwise it takes on a life of its own, and then suddenly you have the learned segment of society telling Shudras that they have to drink boiling ghee to become God conscious. What the? I mean, are you serious? That's like, you know. But hey, there's a certain taste to it. Like the camel likes to eat these thorny twigs because that taste of its own blood in the mouth is like kind of. There is a certain taste to like when you're really Nirjal Ekadashi and you know, yeah, I got up at midnight. I took rest at 11 and got up at midnight, and you know, there's a certain element because of that self-sacrifice, because it means that you're not, you're not a slave to your senses, but then you become a slave to your ego, because you start thinking I'm a better devotee because I got up half an hour earlier than the other devotee, you know, I'm coming out of the shower as he's coming in, you know. I won't even mention it to him, you know. I'm a generous devotee. So the ego gets boosted by that, you know. It takes over. It's very, very subtle. So that's why we need authority. And that's why we need, as a international society for Krishna consciousness, we're meant to provide that environment where Krishna consciousness can flourish. You see, an institution can't provide Krishna consciousness. People, it's just like you can't convince people. People can become Krishna conscious, but we can provide a framework where it's easier to become Krishna conscious than if you're just fending for yourself in material society, right? So that's the purpose of ISKCON, is to propagate this knowledge. And that's why we need to educate more educators. We have Bhakti Shastri, that's great, but we have to take it further. It's not enough. We're not good enough at this philosophy. We can quote a lot of verses, but can we present it in such a way that it makes sense to people, that they can see this relates to my life right here and now? Or is it just Prabhupada said, Krishna says, you know? We can't demand that people get this. We have to get it ourselves, and then we have to present it in such a way that they can see this makes sense in my life, right? So you're not the body, Prabhu. Okay, that doesn't. But if you can explain how, okay, the cells and they reproduce and there's something like we did just before, then it starts. We start to relate to it. Oh my God, it's actually true, right? So. Yeah, because there's not enough focus on this in ISKCON, education, actually. You know, I mean, the brahmacharis are great because they're basically like very, very cheap labor. But that's not one of the principles of brahmacharya, is study, right? That's what it is. So how much are we studying? And that's the difference between reading and studying. Because reading, you read it and then, oh yeah, this makes perfect sense. To what? To your material mind, which is an illusion, so you may have missed the point, right? So that's what the self-realized soul can do, is that you read something, that doesn't mean that, it means something else, you missed a point here, there's a word here that you neglected, or something, you know what I mean? That's what guru means, that he's been around the block a little longer, so he knows all these traps that we're facing. And he has his own traps. It's like Bhaktivinoda Thakur says, the last snare of Maya is the thought that I'm a great devotee and a guru of others. Because it's true. So nobody's going to arrest you on it. Nobody's going to disagree with you. And then that false ego remains. It's a good situation to be in. It's kind of nice, you know. When you're like me, I was traveling around India and giving a lot of classes. And basically, you know, being treated a little bit like a sannyasi, it's kind of nice, you know, people serving you food and Jai Prabhu coming, picking me up in car and stuff. And it's pretty cool, you know. So then you start believing them when they say you're a great person. You know, start, yeah, I'm actually doing pretty well here, you know. And that's not going to get you into Godhead. Because imagine you go into the rasa dance with that mentality. What's the first thing you're going to think? It's like, whoa, check me out. Look at where I am. And you're going to break the whole mood and all the gopis are going to, who's this guy over there? What, you know, it's not about that. It's about Krishna, You know, so it's not going to work. So you can get stuck on that for thousands of lifetimes. Yeah, I'm doing pretty well here. Because you are. But pretty well is not what we want. We want devotion. So that's the problem, right? That if you approach it from this, I want the suffering to stop perspective, it starts out really well because you are motivated. That's why it's so difficult sometimes to preach to successful people, because they think they're doing pretty well. So it's easier with like drug addicts and drunkards and what these crazy people, because they know they're suffering. They actually understand that. So it's a great motivator when you're suffering. You want the suffering to stop, because there's inherent in the soul, there's this idea that we're supposed to be happy. It's a natural quality. But then the problem is, as soon as the pain starts to go away, so does your motivation, right? If the motivation was to get the pain to stop, you don't have to be like a devotee or hang out with the Krishnas for very long. You stop drinking, you start chanting, you start feeling pretty good, and then the motivation goes away, right? So then the ego comes up. Oh yeah, I'm pretty good. I'm doing well. Oh, and now I'm initiated. Oh, second initiated. Wow. Oh, saffron. Hey, you know, doing pretty well. Not so much, because the devotion is gone. It's become mundane religion. That's the problem. That if we say we're not sectarian, but everyone else is, that's about the most sectarian thing you can say. And we say it constantly, right? So we have to be very, very careful with this. If that's the point, like back to this the discussion with this elderly gentleman who was a Muslim, there was no problem. We were preaching to each other very effectively because it was not sectarian. It didn't even come up. So if we can present ourselves to the public at large like that, we will be extremely attractive. People are attracted. They are attracted. We just have to stop getting in the way of ourselves. It's like Prabhupada, we'd have to say he's doing pretty well, right? Pretty much Jagat Guru of Kali Yuga, doing okay. Books, perfect, right? It's the word of God. So when people are not coming, it's not because of Prabhupada, it's not because of the books. It's because we're not ambitious enough, actually. It's not about buildings. Buildings are great, but they're only buildings. They're material. Come back after 50 years and it's decaying, right? This is quite a bit of work with this building, because it's an old building, so, and it costs a lot of money to run it, because, you know, yeah, it's big and it's old. That's important because it creates the framework, but it's not the goal. The goal is Krishna consciousness. So are we actually using them to attract people? Is it actually working, right? We have to be very, very careful with that. And, I mean, you know, I study a lot, so that for my approach is education. We have to bump that up. If we have so many funds for buildings, where's the funds for education? I mean, there should be some kind of, you know, balance in that. Because if it's just a building, it's just a building. The building's not going to make any devotees. We are. But are we? Right? So we have to educate ourselves. That's what, because if it's just about being comfortable, then that comes quite easy. You just follow the lifestyle. That's not the philosophy. That's not, you know, you have culture and philosophy. So that's the culture. The culture will make you comfortable, right? You're regulated, you're a vegetarian, you're not drinking, you're not smoking, you're pretty healthy, you know, you're comfortable. The body is not uncomfortable by that. But then the inspiration, right? That's the utsaha, that which is going to drive it forward, that bhava. Because we all have bhava. We experience it on the festivals, right? Where everyone's there and we're happy and enthusiastic. It's there. It's actually bhava we're feeling. Everything runs on bhava, you know? It doesn't run on regulation. It doesn't run on philosophy. It doesn't run on buildings. It runs on bhava. So we have the various ways of arranging the International Society for Krishna Consciousness in such a way that it becomes easy to bring out that bhava. And one thing is buildings, another thing is education, knowledge, that we can present it in such a way that their minds are blown. I mean, we can say stuff that blows people's minds. We can describe what the mind is, right? People discuss whether social sciences is actually a science, and I would tend to agree. It's a gray area, because in modern society, people don't know what the mind is, how it works, right? How does free will work, right? People can't say that. How does a thought appear? You know, people say, oh, we're objective, we're scientific, we have data and we're analyzing. Yeah, but how do you analyze? How do you know that your thought is related to reality, right? Big Bang is not an explanation of how a universe comes into being. It's just, I have this image, this vision of two scientists in the laboratory, and one of them comes up with, it's a bang. It came by a bang, and the other guy's like, nah, I don't know. I mean, I don't know. I don't think we can sell that one. Okay, how about Big Bang? Now you got something, right? And we buy it. It's ridiculous. Big Bang, right? It doesn't explain anything. So unless we understand how the mind works with the emotions, the intelligence, the ego, which can be false or more or less in line with reality, we are in a state of psychosis. How can you say you're objective? 7.5 billion people on the planet, all subjective, except me. I'm objective. People think like that. That's psychotic. Straight up, right? So if we can present it in in such a way with a little bit of humor, people will take it. They will come. They will come. But we have to educate ourselves a little more. We have to read the books. It's hard, I know. It's harder for me to read now than it was 10 years ago. I had 3 years as a brahmachari where I didn't have a telephone at all. And then I started traveling, and I thought to myself, the easiest way to kind of manage that is just open a Facebook account, because everyone's on Facebook, so you can just arrange everything, the logistics and all that. And now, every day, I'm scrolling through the newsfeed like a freaking moron, you know? It's just what happens, and I can't read the same way I could 10 years ago. My attention span has been is in closer proximity to that of a goldfish, right? People can focus for like 3 seconds at a time, literally. Then something has to happen. So you sit down with a book, that's like torture. Nothing's happening. The words are just like standing there, you know? And you have to actually go through it meticulously, one sentence at a time. It's horrible. But then once you kind of get past that initial terror, there is a deeper reward in it, right? So we have to get a little bit more on that. We have to keep reading Prabhupada's books. As far as I know, it was the only kind of critique he had of his disciples, where you're not reading my books. I mean, the dedication, the surrender, the enthusiasm was amazing when Prabhupada was here. But the reading, you know? So it's it's so funny that people come up to me and kind of sometimes ask, also when I was a brahmachari, like, what do you do all day? And then I give a class and it's like, wow, where do you get it from? Well, you know, connect the dots. It's right there. Some of the points that I make that people, they get very amazed by, it's straight out of Bhagavad Gita. It's not like amazing points. It's not like some secret books that I've got that nobody else has access to. It's straight up Bhagavad Gita, second chapter. And if you notice, like when people ask questions after class, very rarely do we get past the first chapter of Bhagavad Gita in the doubts and questions that devotees have. It's all about how do I balance my material and spiritual life. That's like 50% of the questions I get, is that one question. There is no material life. Spirit means life, matter means death. Maya is the idea that there is such a thing as material life. So understanding that there is only spiritual life, and how does that connect? So, oh, but my job, yeah, you do the job because it's your duty. That's, okay, now we're at third chapter of Bhagavad Gita, right? It's going forward, right? So it's connected with Krishna. Nothing moves without Krishna. So it may not be the temple you're working at. It may be something very different from the temple, but it's still Krishna is still doing it, and you're still doing it for Krishna. So it's just indirect instead of direct, right? So if we read daily, You know, I read a chapter of Gita every day. It's not that hard. The only thing that's hard is sitting down and getting onto it, right? Opening the book. But then once you're reading, I mean, there's immediate reward. That you can see that this is not written by a human being. It's not mundane. It's not like a Facebook update, you know. This is transcendental stuff. And it's very inspiring. That's the recounts for half of the rest of the questions I get is how do I become more enthusiastic in devotional service, right? You just read. That's where it comes from. Understanding what it is we're dealing with will naturally make us hyper enthusiastic because we're dealing with God. He's a pretty cool guy. I mean, he's right up there with Prabhupada, right? It's amazing what we have, but if we're not reading, we forget it. You know, we forget. And then it's like, oh, how do I manage my material and spiritual life? You know? So wherever we have a value, that's where our mind will gravitate towards. Right? So we have to work a little to build up that value of reading Prabhupada's books and studying his books and talking about it. That's like a conversation I was recently having with a very dear friend of mine who's now, he's in Mayapur, so there's a bit of distance between us. And that was such a juicy conversation because he reads a lot too and studies a lot too. And so you take that compared to that mundane conversation with four people just taking turns talking about nothing. It's just two different worlds, you know. So, but we have to put in that little bit of effort. That's why everything starts with Shraddha. Everything runs on Bhava. That is the fuel that everything runs on. But it starts with Shraddha, faith. Anything you want to do, you have to have a little bit of faith and suspend your disbelief for a while until you get that result, right? If you want to make a sandwich, you have to have a little bit of faith that it will taste nice and you will not be hungry afterwards and you won't drop it on the floor. That's what happens when people get depressed. They lose the faith in anything because they're usually quite intelligent people who can see how pointless material life is. So they're actually in less illusion than the slightly psychopathic people who just trug on, right? But in the same way with spiritual, if we're talking about going back to Godhead, that's a tall order. You have to have a little bit of faith that it'll work. And so when we sit down and read, we have to push ourselves to do that. If it doesn't come naturally, you have to do it anyway, right? So there are many things in life. We think when we're a child, we want to be adult because we can do whatever we want. And when we're adult, we dream of when we were a child because we could do whatever we want. We can't do whatever we want. We're going to be, it's not going to work. And our ability to have that faith to suspend our immediate satisfaction, that's what's going to secure our success, right? And so if anything, that's what's going to build this spontaneous devotion that Mahaprabhu is bringing out in people. It's not the religion, but the religion is the tool to get there. So understanding this primary and secondary is absolutely essential if we want to expand our international society for Krishna consciousness, right? If it's going to work, because technically right now it's not working. We're going to die. I mean, the Gaudiya mat went down. Why can't ISKCON? It's up to us. We can't undo what Prabhupada did. The books are out. It's been spread. Everyone knows about Hare Krishna, right? That's been done. We can't undo that. But everything we're doing, we can undo that, right? So in 20 years, we have to have made a lot of devotees because the people who are paying now are going to be gone. And then what? I'm dead serious. This is something that we really have to look at, right? Who's in charge and what direction are they leading us? You know, I mean, Bhagavatam's class is not for politics, but I'm not talking politics here. I'm talking straight up fact, you know. This is the reality that we're looking at. We have to put more emphasis on studying and preaching. There's a difference between teaching and preaching. Preaching means when people have not yet been convinced. So You see, Bhagavad Gita has three parts: Sambandha, Prayojana, Abhideya. The first part is just the situation we're in, six chapters. Then you have the goal, Krishna. And then you have the Abhideya, how to get it, the technical points are the last chapters. So it's preaching. It's showing us why should we do all the technical things before that we're expected to do it. And that's how we should approach people also. We have to make them interested. Then we can explain to them how it works. Right? But that means we have to know it ourselves. Hare Krishna, time's running out. Question?